Welcome to Oncology Today. Key presentations from the 2024 American Society of Hematology Annual Meeting, Myelofibrosis Edition. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Rajit Rampal from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. In addition to this interview, there's a corresponding video program featuring Dr. Rampal's slide presentation. To begin, I asked Dr. Rampal about his thought process on when to initiate therapy for patients with myelofibrosis. You had a review article, Leukemia and Lymphoma, that I thought was really excellent, that went through a lot of these issues. But just to bring up a couple, one is the issue of when to start therapy. You know, in the beginning, when we first saw the COMFORT data came out, you know, it kind of seemed like it was really focused on symptomatic patients. As the years have gone on, I'm hearing more and more discussion about starting therapy, ruxolitinib in particular, earlier. Can you talk a little bit about how you see that and where you see that heading?
This is a great question, right? To me, this is very much in its current form, an art more than it is a science, because, you know, are there patients we see who are both started too early and too late? Absolutely there are. So maybe we start by defining that. Who is the patient who is too late? The patient to me who is too late is somebody who has, you know, had terrible constitutional symptoms and whose spleen is, you know, now in the pelvis. Because the problem is, even with a JAK inhibitor at its maximum dose, the likelihood that you're going to get that spleen back to normal is very unlikely. Right, and these are patients I think who should always be prioritized in clinical trials. But you're also dealing with the consequences of that: the portal hypertension, likely cytopenias because of hypersplenism. You get into a very difficult spot with those patients, and to me, that is kind of the definition of the patient who comes to treatment too late. What's the other side of that? The other side of that is the patient who comes to treatment too early, right? And sometimes, you know, you have a patient who has very modest splenomegaly, let's say, you know, 3 to 5 centimeters below the costal margin on examination, who doesn't really feel too bad, is generally functioning and working. Sometimes, you know, we see this patient and we say, well, we have JAK inhibitors, let's start early. The question is, what are we going to gain by doing that, right? And that's a hard question to answer, because yes, we can shrink the spleen, but we also are in a position in a patient like that to invite side effects that may be detrimental to that patient's quality of life. So the trigger of where to start, to me, a lot of it is based on symptoms. When we are coming to the point where symptoms are encroaching on a patient's quality of life, that's a clear indication to start. The spleen becomes a little bit more of a challenging thing, in the sense that if somebody's spleen is growing slowly, they can become acclimated to this, right? And so you can have patients, you know, whose spleen is down to the umbilicus on examination, who don't notice it that much because they've become used to it. Oftentimes, if you probe enough, or if there's a family member present, you will start to elicit that there are, you know, impediments from that. But to me, that's the critical part of this, is really kind of getting down to making sure that the patient really isn't symptomatic, because more often than not, that type of patient is having symptoms. And I think you have to think about, number one, have they crossed the threshold symptomatically? But also, number two, are you in danger of this patient becoming that patient with spleen going into the pelvis? And that's what you want to avoid. So that's why I would say it's a bit of an art.
Another sort of general question. Again, I'm not sure how much we learn in addition to what we learned earlier on, but just kind of curious where you are today, is how to stop ruxolitinib when you have a patient who has disease progression. What have we learned about that, and how do you go about doing that?
So I guess let's maybe take the scenario of where you're going to switch patient to a different JAK inhibitor, right? You know, this has to be done very judiciously. And this really is owing to the pharmacokinetics of ruxolitinib as well as the other drugs. There is a longer time to, you know, onset of most of our other JAK inhibitors in terms of benefit for symptom and spleen. And so I think, to me, if somebody is on a low dose of ruxolitinib, let's say they're on 5 twice daily, you can probably reasonably switch them the next day. Give them the last dose of ruxolitinib on Wednesday, and on Thursday they start their other JAK inhibitor. It's more complicated in a patient who's on a higher dose, and I would define a higher dose as 10 or 15 or higher twice daily. In those patients, my practice has always been to taper down the dose to ideally 5 twice a day, and then switch them over as I described. Sometimes there are impediments to doing that. And, you know, if let's say you have a patient who's just very sensitive to withdrawal from JAK inhibitor, they're very symptomatic, you can overlap. We've done that in practice where we've overlapped 2 JAK inhibitors for a day or two and then take the ruxolitinib away because it does have a relatively short half-life. So I think overlap is okay in people who you know are not going to do well being off of a good JAK inhibitor control.
In terms of the type of symptoms and issues that you see on withdrawal, I've always kind of visualized it like you go back to the symptoms that you had before from myelofibrosis. Is that the way you see it? Is anything in particular early on?
Yeah, I think that's correct, right? But I think sometimes it comes back with a vengeance because if the JAK inhibitor is withdrawn too quickly, all of those symptoms come flooding back, right? And so people can get quite sick. So I think it is a very cautionary thing with ruxolitinib, right? And I think one of the things that's important to maybe communicate to the audience, right, is we do end up in situations where, for example, a patient comes into a local ER, they didn't bring their ruxolitinib with them. Now they're getting admitted for some unrelated cause. Now what do you do? They're not going to have the ruxolitinib. And that's a dangerous situation because that can be life-threatening, particularly if a patient has been on a high dose of JAK inhibitor. So it's always better to taper the JAK inhibitor regardless of what the next move is, whether it's taking them off for some reason or switching to another JAK inhibitor. But if that can't be done, then steroids are the saving grace. You can bridge people with a short burst of prednisone that will usually attenuate the risk.
So another question, but just kind of curious, what's your vision about the pathophysiology of why you see splenomegaly in myelofibrosis? What exactly is going on?
This is a fantastic question, right? So I think the current thought is that this is migration of both malignant and normal stem cells. And part of the proof of that is that if you take spleen tissue from a human with myelofibrosis and you implant that in a mouse, the mouse will get myelofibrosis. So this is a reservoir of stem cells. So there's a migration that occurs. Why does that occur? This is still a subject of investigation. I mean, you know, obviously spleen and liver are at least in utero hematopoietic tissues, not so much in the adult, but is some of the, microenvironment still amenable to hematopoiesis? The answer is yes. So that may be the reason. Now, how and why exactly does that migration occur? That is, I think, less clear.
Interesting. So a couple other questions of things I saw in your CV that we didn't talk about, but I was just really curious about. One, CDK4/6 inhibitor. I see abemaciclib in myelofibrosis. What's the thinking biologically, and what do we know about this?
Yeah, great. So, a number of pathways are upregulated by the JAK-STAT pathway, and one in particular is cell cycle. So PIM kinases, of course, are part of the regulation of the cell cycle. They're upregulated, and as we just talked about, PIM kinase inhibitors have been studied by us in the lab as well as others. And now clinically, inhibitors are in clinical practice, in trials, and are showing efficacy. But the same thing is true of CDK4/6, which is clearly upregulated in myelofibrosis. And so we and others have tested this in mouse models of myelofibrosis with ruxolitinib and seen that there is a clear synergy between the drugs, that there is reductions in spleen size of mice, and there's actually a survival benefit in at least one study in mice. So that has led us to start a phase 1 trial of ruxolitinib and abemaciclib, one of the FDA-approved CDK4/6 inhibitors for metastatic breast cancer. And that trial is currently open and accruing, and our hope is that we will present the data at ASH this year.
It's interesting you picked abema because the other two approved, palbo and ribo, caused neutropenia. And I don't even know whether that's a clue to what's going on with myelofibrosis, but why did you pick abema?
Part of the answer is a practical answer, right? This is the drug we had access to, but part of it is exactly what you described, which is there tends to be less cytopenias with abemaciclib, some more in the way of GI side effects, but that's kind of what we wanted to avoid, especially in combination with ruxolitinib.
All right, so now to kind of get back into some of the papers that you were talking about, and particularly from the point of view of the general medical oncologist in a community-based practice, first, could you just talk a little bit more about the JUMP study? It sounds like, quote, a real-world study, which I always find interesting. Can you go over it and talk a little bit about what you think it means in terms of, you know, day-to-day clinical practice?
Yeah, you know, I think the way I think about this is that whenever we do clinical trials, right, the patients that we enroll in clinical trials are not always, are often not reflective of the patients we actually take care of in practice, right? And that's the benefit of JUMP to me, is that this is an observational study in myelofibrosis patients who this was over 2,000 patients, right? So it gives us a really broad number of patients. But the data that we were, you know, talking about was really pertaining to how the patients do when we break things down by their hemoglobin. This is sort of the opposite of how we think about a lot of the studies we do, where we say, well, let's take anemic patients and do X intervention and see if we boost their hemoglobin. This is looking at it the other way and saying, fine, you, in the real world, you have somebody in your clinic who has a hemoglobin of 9.8. Which treatment will you give them? Are you going to give them momelotinib? Are you going to give them ruxolitinib? And can you expect that you're going to get the same benefit in that anemic patient by giving them ruxolitinib? And at least that the data from JUMP supports the idea that you can, right? And that you can intervene with things like ESAs, which this is a very practical solution, right, in the real world to try to improve anemia. But the takeaway to me from that, you know, particular study was that, yeah, you can actually manage people through this and get the clinical benefit. So it gives you more of options when you think about treatment for patients with myelofibrosis, meaning that it's not that if you have anemia, you must go on this drug. There's more nuance to it than that.
It kind of also leads into the question I hear a lot from oncologists, which is you start out ruxolitinib in somebody with a pretty decent hemoglobin and then it drops. Do you switch to momelotinib?
So this is really important. This is really key. One of the things I've seen over and over is, for example, because we dose ruxolitinib by platelets, let's say you have a patient whose, you know, hemoglobin is 9.8 at the outset, but their platelets are 200,000, right? So you put them on a high dose of ruxolitinib, and not unexpectedly, as you say, hemoglobin drops abruptly. The doc gets concerned and, you know, stops the ruxolitinib, and now you kind of end up in a vicious cycle of, do you rechallenge? At what dose do you rechallenge? And I think that what JUMP and other studies that have historically been done in this setting say to us is that you can overcome anemia, and you should try to overcome the anemia, especially early on, because the patient will still ultimately benefit from being on that on ruxolitinib in this case. But you have to think about bridging them through the anemia. And, you know, one way to do it is, as, you know, in the JUMP study, people got additional modalities to boost the hemoglobin. The other way to think about it is to gradually increase the dose. Don't go by the platelet count, but rather increase the dose from 5 to 10 to 15 to goal. To me, that's the strategy I often employ, but I think that's the real implication here.
So it sounds like you try to, you know, support the patient in terms of their anemia and keep them on ruxolitinib rather than switch necessarily?
Yeah, exactly, if I can, right? Now there are some patients where this doesn't necessarily makes sense, right? So somebody, let's say, who comes in, hemoglobin is 7.8, and you're needing to start therapy. Obviously, your window is not so big there to try to, rescue that. And so in a patient like that, does momelotinib make much more sense to me? I think the answer to me is yes. And there's also practical concerns, right? I think this is something that my colleagues around the country, as I talk to people, you have to think about the practicalities of life. And if you've got a patient who is in a more rural setting, does it make more sense to treat that patient who has baseline anemia with a drug like momelotinib, where they're hopefully going to get that anemia benefit? Or is this somebody who can realistically come in back and forth to the clinic and get transfused and get their blood counts checked? Often this is a practical reality.
So I can't remember whether it was spleen or symptoms that momelotinib didn't do as well as ruxolitinib in the randomized trial. But do you think that clinically? Do you think it's maybe a little bit less effective than ruxolitinib?
Yeah, exactly. So in Simplify 1, in the randomized phase 3 of ruxolitinib versus momelotinib, the drugs, momelotinib was non-inferior in terms of spleen size reduction, but momelotinib was not non-inferior in terms of symptoms, right? And my clinical experience has been that from constitutional symptoms, ruxolitinib still seems to be the drug that gives us the most bang for our buck. So, you know, when choosing a JAK inhibitor, that plays into the equation. What's driving the decision to treat?
So another question kind of related to this issue of anemia is the role of luspatercept in these patients. And also I saw you discussing a drug that sounds like has the same name or similar name, elritercept, that was presented at ASH. So what about these two drugs?
Yeah, so I mean, so luspatercept has phase 2 data behind it in myelofibrosis, and it doesn't have it has NCCN designation, but doesn't have FDA approval for this. But it was studied both with and without ruxolitinib, and it seemed to have a higher response rate in combination with ruxolitinib. So it gives you another tool to use aside from an ESA or you know, in lieu of an ESA if that's not an option. We've used it clinically quite a bit and have been you know, we've seen very favorable results. The elritercept data, as I alluded to, it kind of surprised, at least it surprised me, in the sense that there was spleen reduction also observed, and you know, some symptom improvements. And again, it's rational in the sense that it's targeting TGF beta signaling, which we know is a component of the pathogenesis of the disease. So I guess on some level it shouldn't surprise us, but this has not been something that has been a focus of these types of drugs like luspatercept in other studies. So I think that's very intriguing, actually.
That was really interesting. Let's talk a little bit about BET inhibition. You provided some update on palbociclib as well as a newer agent. Can you just kind of review basically how these agents work, what kind of tolerability complications you see with them, and where you see it heading?
Yeah. So the BET is involved in the regulation of a number of proteins, but it's heavily involved in the NF-kappa-B pathway, which we have known for some time is involved in the pathogenesis of myelofibrosis. It's responsible for the production of a lot of the inflammatory cytokines that we see. Again, There are multiple proteins that have bromo domains, but targeting those as part of the pathogenesis of the disease makes rational sense. And again, this has been credentialed on a preclinical level. The drugs were studied initially in MANIFEST, and these are MANIFEST trial, and that included patients who were untreated, so they were given it in combination with Rux, or people who had been treated with Rux and were given it as a single agent or as an add-on. And that data all looked good. People did have further spleen size response and symptom response, and in some cases an anemia response. So that really gave credence to this as a clinical investigational agent. So the current data shows us that you continue to see deepening of spleen response. Hemoglobin seems to be higher. Symptoms are trending in the right direction. What are the toxicities? There's no free lunch. We do see that there is a little bit more thrombocytopenia with the combination of the two drugs versus ruxolitinib, but there's less anemia, which is interesting. The one major side effect that we have seen is dysgeusia. But dysgeusia that was observed is dose dependent. If you reduce the dose, it gets better. And only one patient on that 400 patient study had to come off the study because of the dysgeusia. It's a real issue for patients, but again, it does get better with dose reduction. But cytopenias can be an on-target effect of these drugs. There were GI side effects and cytopenias. So again, it continues to be heavy interest in this as a therapeutic target. I think the manifest data continues to mature. Hopefully, we'll be seeing the week 72 data update cut coming in the relatively near future. But again, I think if it continues to show deepening, that's highly encouraging. I think the other thing I would say, and full disclosure and interest, I was the lead author on the study, so I'm not trying to talk about this more than anything else, but I just know more about this than other things. you know, there were biological markers that improved. Fibrosis improved more with combination versus single agent. Inflammatory cytokines improved more with combination than single agent. So there's, I would say, kind of a gestalt that this may be a disease modifying therapy. But, you know, let's see further data and prove that.
So you also talked about the issue of selinexor and the possible combination with ruxolitinib. Can you talk a little bit more about tolerability? And, you know, we hear a lot from the myeloma, as you were talking about initially, a lot of issues are there in terms of tolerability, GI and other side effects. Now, I think with dose modifications, it seems to be better. Just kind of curious how it's been playing out with myelofibrosis.
I think you said the key thing, dose modification, right? I mean, I was involved with selinexor trials in AML where we were using much higher doses than we are in this study, and it was very difficult for patients to tolerate it. The doses that are being used here are 60 milligrams and 40 milligrams weekly. And, you know, I guess one way to look at it or kind of answer the question is that, you know, if you look at some of the selinexor data that's been presented at ASH, one thing that's sort of compelling and maybe alleviate some of our concerns is that symptoms as well as spleen got better in many patients. And that would not have been my expectation if it was a, you know, highly intolerable drug. And in the, if my recollection is correct from the presentation at ASH 2 years ago, a number of patients did have to be dose reduced to the 40 milligram dosing. But it did seem that they were able to stay on the therapy, which I think is the other thing that gives us some credence.
So there's kind of an interesting observation. We just we did this multi-tumor program this past weekend. One of the things we were talking about was endometrial cancer, where selinexor is being looked at also. And the thing there that's interesting and a little bit perplexing to me is that it seems to do better in P53 wild-type patients. Any correlation with P53 and myelofibrosis?
Yeah, this is a good question because the exact question has come up multiple times as people have looked at this. At the moment, I'm not aware of any data pertaining to P53, but I think this is a question that must be examined.
And what fraction of patients with MF are P53 mutant?
It's not a high proportion in the chronic phase of the disease. I would say, you know, somewhere between 3-5%. But at the time of transformation leukemia, then it becomes closer to 30-40%, right? So there is evolution that occurs over time, and we may be, you know, only seeing that when the disease changes character. But I think we all get concerned when we see this in a patient with myelofibrosis.
So speaking of P53, hopefully you can explain to me about navtemalin. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly, but MDM2 inhibitor. First of all, again, in terms of mechanisms, you were mentioning something about P53. Can you go back over how it works?
Yeah, exactly. So MDM2 on a protein level regulates expression of P53, meaning that when it is there, it reduces the amount of P53 protein. And so the concept here is that if you inhibit MDM2's function, there's more functional P53 protein to carry out apoptosis and other cellular activities. So that's kind of the major concept. There's abundant preclinical data to support this idea. So one of the things that has been observed in a prior study of an MDM2 inhibitor is that, you know, if you think about this on a protein level and you say, well, fine, you can increase the amount of P53 protein. Is that also true of P53 mutant protein? And there was a prior study of a different MDM2 inhibitor that did in fact show that in patients who had only really small levels of P53 mutations, the level of the mutation, the VAF, increased markedly. It was not associated with any disease progression, but it did increase even the mutated form of the protein. So I think that, you know, again, it plays into the concept of how the drug works, but also raises a concern about how it may work.
So I'm just kind of curious, you know, for us outside, you know, we look and see these new trials and everything sort of looks exciting. It's kind of hard to differentiate it, but this really did look exciting. And I'm kind of curious, do you know, does this stand out to you, these preliminary data? Do you think this trial where they're going to, you know, randomize between continuing Rux and people who aren't doing that well on it and this new MDM2 drug, you think it's going to be positive? I mean, I know you need to see the data, but are you optimistic this drug's going to end up in practice?
I guess the way I would probably answer that is that, you know, I think most, if not all of the things that we've talked about, you know, from MASH have good biological rationale. And that to me is one of the things that stands out, you know, versus just empirically trying different drugs for the sake of trying them. And so I'm optimistic from that standpoint, right? But the question always becomes is, you know, if something doesn't work, is it the wrong drug or the wrong target? I'm less inclined to think that we have the wrong targets. The question is always, are these the right drugs and are they targeting the target enough? You know, I think I'm optimistic about everything that I see. Of course, experience tells us that, you know, many, if not most things will not pan out, but if only some do, that's a good start. You know, the naftamadlin study to me is innovative just because of the trial design. I think we've never done a study like that in myelofibrosis. And again, to me, that it resonates because on a practical level, this is exactly how I predict a drug would be used were it to be approved. So I think they're doing exactly the right study. BET inhibitors, I think, you know, still remain a strong contender for making a difference in the field. And there's a host of other things that, you know, weren't presented at ASH this year that I also think are really compelling and may make a difference moving forward.
Would you like to sort of outline some of those?
Sure. You know, I think one of the things that has created a great deal of excitement in the field in the last year, year and a half, is calreticulin antibodies. So calreticulin, of course, is one of the driver mutations in myelofibrosis, but the protein actually is expressed on the cell surface in combination with the thrombopoietin receptor, meaning that it is a target. And so right now there are two phase one trials of calreticulin antibodies. One of them is a BiTE that are ongoing and enrolling MF patients and ET patients. This is exciting because, I mean, this is a concept that's now gone from bench to bedside in an unprecedentedly rapid manner. We'll see what we see at the end of the day. We're treating patients with both drugs at MSK, and I think it's too early to say anything, but I think we continue to enroll in these trials. There are, of course, the next generation of JAK inhibitors, drugs that are more selective and more potent that have just entered clinical trials in the last few months. So, you know, getting better targeting of JAK2 seems to be perhaps an achievable goal. And so those studies are ongoing as well. And, you know, I would be remiss if I also didn't say that, yeah, we're encouraged by some of the work that we're doing with cell cycle inhibitors like abemaciclib. And, you know, we'll see where the data leads us.
So when you talked about calreticulin receptors, I was somehow thought you were going to end up saying AD, you know, antibody drug conjugates. Any role, any thought about ADCs and MF?
That's an interesting idea. I mean, I think if you can create an antibody, you know, that targets them, why couldn't you take the next step, as you're saying, and think about something with a payload? I think that's a reasonable idea. I'm not aware if anything going on with that particular concept at the moment, but certainly seems like a rational idea.
I mean, most of the ADCs out there now, and you know, there may be some in the future that aren't, but most of them have payloads that are chemo. I mean, would chemo work if it was targeted in myelofibrosis?
Right. You know, that answers that raises another question. I mean, I don't think that there's a reason to think that it wouldn't, you know, in terms of thinking about the biology of and the pathways involved in MPN. But it's a testable hypothesis, a reasonable one.
So you also mentioned a paper from ASH of an agent. Again, it was a letter and number agent. I think it began with CK. You described related to Tregs. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about that and other strategies using it? I don't know if you call it immunotherapy, but T-cell therapy.
Yeah, so this was sort of a novel thing to me when I saw this presentation, right? So this is using Tregs, and I have to be honest, I don't know too much about the background of this or where else it's being employed. But I mean, this is not something we've done in myelofibrosis, as far as I know. And again, it's predicated on a specific cytokine pathway, which is upregulated in myelofibrosis. So the rationale here is good in terms of what the pathway being targeted. But you know, how much immune dysfunction there is in myelofibrosis, I think this is an area that is being investigated. But there's a lot more questions and answers right now here.
So another great paper I found that you wrote, again, I'm kind of curious if anything came out at ASH related to that, or you just want to make a general comment. Prevention and treatment of transformation of myeloproliferative neoplasm to AML and hematologica. Can you talk about that issue, what you're trying to get into with that paper, and whether, again, anything's come out recently that's related to that?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, this is the key, one of the key worries of patients and physicians, right? 25% of patients with myelofibrosis will transform to AML, and the outcomes are really quite dismal when that happens. A lot of it is P53 driven, right? And so these are often P53 multi-hit complex carrier type AMLs. We don't have good answers for that in general, right? I mean, we need to obviously do better, and that's a whole other topic. But the question and what we were kind of positing in this paper was, is there a better way to prognosticate the patients who are at highest risk, right? Because, you know, if we think about the way we do things now, right? When we see a patient, we do their initial bone marrow, we get their baseline genetics, and we use a DIPSS score or a MIPSS score, and we say, well, this is your risk. But one of the things that we are not doing, I think, enough of, and we need to do better, is reassessing risk over time. We know that, you know, mutational burden changes over time, that copy number changes over time. And if we were to look at this in a prospective manner and say, well, if you were to sequence patients as a standard of care every year, would you be able to identify those who are actually showing early evolution prior to them transforming? Is this a reasonable idea? I think the answer is yes, because one of the observations that we have, which is hopefully to be published and presented soon, but certainly happy to share it, is that the bulk of the mutations that occur at the time of transformation exist at the time of chronic phase disease. And if that's true, then that tells us that you may be able to pick up on this at an earlier time point. So I think that that's one of the major things that we were arguing in this study. The second thing is that when we do our clinical trials, right, we have to think about moving beyond spleen and symptoms as our endpoints, right? What we really want to get ultimately, of course, is overall survival, but a more realistic surrogate of that is progression-free survival. And we really, I think we need to think about doing our trials in a way that focus on progression-free survival. And of course, is the spleen and symptom aspect important? Yes, but I don't think it's the most important thing. And really trying to do trials that are addressing PFS, that is part of the way we need to think about reducing the risk of patients transforming.
For in terms of, you know, picking up earlier signs of potential transformation, right now clinically, is there anything you would do about it?
You know, in a patient who is a candidate, let's just say I saw, you know, genomic evolution, right? I think I would be more inclined to transplant or refer to transplant, because it's obvious that transplant certainly is curative in patients. But the question in transplant is sort of like the question you were asking about in JAK inhibitor. When do you transplant a patient? This is a hard question because it does come with an enormous risk. But, you know, one of the conundrums we face is that patients come in, newly diagnosed MF, they're sick, they don't feel well. You put them on a JAK inhibitor, they feel much better, they're living their life. But then you look at their genetics and say, well, listen, you are actually high risk of transforming to AML. And the patient says, I feel good, I'm living my life. Why should I take this 20% chance of dying from a transplant? This is the difficulty, right? This is part of the difficulty. And I think the more credence we give to the genomics or other biomarkers to say to a patient, you know, this is a substantial risk, and if we intervene now, we can still potentially have a long-term benefit versus what we do now, which is kind of waiting for something bad to happen and then trying to transplant the patient. That, to me, would also make a difference in outcome.
Yeah, you got into the question I was going to ask you, which was about the issue of timing of transplant. Is it just genomic factors and other biomarkers, or are there clinical factors too?
I think clinical factors as well, right? I mean, I think, you know, if a patient is showing signs of progression of disease, and which I would define as, you know, they've developed a new onset anemia requiring transfusions, or now the spleen is starting to get bigger, or now the symptoms are starting to recrudesce, those to me are all warning signs that we are going to lose response imminently.
So another great review article that I saw that you did, I'm curious what your thoughts are, relates to ruxolitinib for polycythemia vera. Also, I didn't see a paper, maybe you did one on ET as well, but anything new in terms of JAK inhibitors and ruxolitinib than those two entities, and how do you utilize them?
You know, this to me, polycythemia is actually changing quite rapidly. And I think that there's a couple of important things here. One is that both ruxolitinib and ropeg interferon have shown event-free survival data in randomized trials versus hydroxyurea. This is very important because events in those studies were defined as, you know, myelofibrosis progression, AML progression, thrombotic events. These are the things that we care about and we're worried about in our patients with PV. But now you have data showing that, in fact, that does seem to be the case, that if you treat patients with these agents, you have a relative reduction in risk. Both agents are also showing the ability to reduce the JAK2 allele burden, which, particularly in the case of ruxolitinib, what has been shown is that the patients who do have a substantial reduction in the JAK2 allele burden are the ones who are more likely to achieve that event-free survival. So JAK2 is now becoming, I think, a more important biomarker, whereas previously we said, what do we do with the VAF? Do we follow it? Do we want to reduce it? Nobody knows the answer, but at least more and more the data is saying to us, yes, reducing it actually does make a difference. Earlier utilization of these agents, I think more and more is becoming a compelling thing to me.
So can you be more specific, though, in terms of the type of scenario, both with polycythemia as well as ET, that would get you to think about ruxolitinib?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's the clear cut, right? Somebody's on hydroxyurea and they're developing symptoms. They're having fevers or oral ulcers or skin ulcers from hydroxyurea. This is the clear cut reason to switch. Somebody's on hydroxyurea and they have uncontrolled symptoms, particularly pruritus. This is a clear indication to switch. Now, where it gets a little bit more ambiguous and where I sort of think we need to challenge the field is, let's say you have somebody in their mid-50s and, you know, they're on hydroxyurea because they have been getting frequent phlebotomies and the patient's counts are controlled. Is that sufficient? Is that reasonable enough? Or do we say to ourselves, well, look, the data is saying to us that hydroxyurea is not really good at reducing the allele burden, that reducing it makes a difference in terms of event-free survival. This is where I think, you know, where we are with a key question, because this is the type of scenario that kind of is hard to think about and troubling. Do you take the leap and say the data, you know, in patients who are having resistance or intolerance is compelling to say there is an event-free survival benefit? Does that mean we should switch everybody over, particularly somebody who is younger like this? I think that's where the challenge is, and I'm you know, more and more leaning towards earlier switch to either ropeg interferon or to ruxolitinib in that scenario. In somebody who is, you know, diagnosed at age 76, is that such a meaningful argument? I don't think so, because I think the, you know, likelihood of progression is not that high in that in the patient's natural lifespan.
So I'd just like to conclude with some general thoughts about management of myelofibrosis, all these data coming out. I mentioned the fact that, you know, our primary target audience is a general medical oncologist and community-based practice. And I know you see many patients as second opinions of patients who've been managed by general medical oncology, you know, trying to keep up. Seems like there's like a new indication in oncology almost every day. Okay. I'm just kind of curious. I'm going to say mistakes, but it may be myths, misperceptions, things that you see people doing in MPNs in general, myelofibrosis in particular, that maybe you wouldn't do.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a good point, right? And to maybe preface my answer, I'm a strong believer in partnering with our community oncologist colleagues. Most MPN is taken care of in the community, right? This is what the data says to us. And, you know, I think having patients come to see, you know, referral center for a consultation and kind of coming up with a game plan and then working with our partners in the community benefits the patient because they can stay closer to home. It benefits our partners in the community because, you know, we're able to kind of advise on the latest updates. All that being said, you know, I think there's a couple of key things. One is, you know, our treatment goals in polycythemia vera, exactly as we were alluding to, we have to always take a step back and consider what are we trying to achieve. Of course, reducing the risk of clotting is important, but I would also, you know, come back to this issue of age. We have patients diagnosed in their 30s, 40s, 50s. We have to think longer term in those patients, and putting those patients on hydroxyurea I think to me is something we should start to steer away from, especially in the face of having newer agents like Ropeg interferon that may have a longer term beneficial effect for the patient, because it's not just about controlling the counts in that type of a patient. So I think that's a scenario that should be thought about. Second, I would go back to our earlier conversation about myelofibrosis, right? And thinking about too early versus too late, like you have to, I think, have that in mind when you're treating a myelofibrosis patient. And I would extend that to the conversation about a stem cell transplant, that there is such a thing more often than not as too late or not even referring the patient. That I have seen quite a bit where that's not even become part of the conversation. And, you know, as transplant outcomes have gotten better and transplanting techniques have gotten better, I think we should be a little bit more willing to refer people to stem cell transplant, even if they or the physician decide that that's not the right thing. Having that conversation makes a difference.
So one final question or thought, I'd like to hear what your thoughts are. We did this multi-tumor thing this past weekend. We actually had a session there on myelofibrosis with Dr. Bose from MD Anderson and Dr. Kuykendall from Moffitt in South Florida. We also had a general medical oncologist on the panel. And you know, we had a lot of fellows at that conference that were coming up to me saying hi, et cetera. And I was telling them, you know, that I was thinking about people who were fellows or people who just came into oncology who didn't know what myelofibrosis was like before JAK inhibitors, before ruxolitinib. And the doc, the general oncologist, was saying, yeah, when the COMFORT trials came out, I had like 7 or 8 patients who were like miserable, and I put them all on ruxolitinib. And I'm just kind of curious what you were doing at that time. And to me, it was one of the most dramatic, you know, moments in oncology when that drug was reported and we started to hear about these incredible clinical responses that were occurring. Any recollections or thought for people who weren't around then?
It's an interesting thing, because I was just at the tail of fellowship, you know, when it was approved, but I'd seen patients in clinic before that, and it's sometimes kind of a regretful way of thinking, right? Because you do remember back to patients who just had massive splenomegaly who looked terrible, and would they have benefited if they had access to that drug? Yes, they would have, right? And that's just the nature of, you know, what we do, because we continue to make progress, right? You go back and you think about the patients who did suffer from the disease who could have benefited from modern therapies. I would echo that, right? I mean, we just saw people do very terribly who would have benefited. And we saw people when we started using the drug in practice who did dramatically better and whose life was altered and were able to live again. And I have every confidence that all of our current trainees are continuing to see this, probably more than, you know, we'll see this in even our time in practice. But that is sort of among the things that drives you to continue to do what you do.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Rompel, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for key presentations from the 2024 American Society of Hematology Annual Meeting, Myelofibrosis Edition.